Please be seated. Your next witness.
My next witness is Dr. Anthony Davren. Your full name is Anthony Davren.
It is.
And you have a Bachelor and Master's First Class Honours in Science degrees from the University of Waikato, majoring in Earth Science, and a PhD in Engineering Science from Washington State University.
Yes, that's correct.
You established Hydro Services in 1983, which provides specialist soil moisture monitoring and irrigation management advice to farmers in Canterbury. And in 2016, you merged Hydro Services with Aqualink. In 2019, you established Swims Consulting Limited to continue consulting in irrigation management and soil water related issues.
That's true.
And you overall have 37 years experience in soil water and irrigation management. And you've been an expert witness in a wide variety of environment court cases.
Correct.
Now, you have prepared a brief of evidence dated the 4th of February 2021.
5th of February, I think.
5th of February 2021.
Yes.
And do you have a copy of that document in front of you?
Yes, I do, electronically.
Electronically. Could you please confirm for the court that the contents of that brief of evidence are true and correct to your best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, as part of that statement of evidence, you have a summary, and that is at the end of your brief. At paragraph 55 to 62.
Yes.
Could you please read that summary for the court's benefit?
The intent and methodology of Schedule 10A.4 has been assessed using the Strathclyde Water Limited taken use of water as an example to illustrate the shortcomings. The schedule is shown to be impractical and statistically poorly conceived. The schedule makes no attempt to consider the reliability of the take and use with the daily, monthly and annual volumes, separating out the take and the use. The schedule doesn't consider other essential uses such as frost fighting requirements. The failure to allow for this would leave enterprises like Strathclyde and their supplier, Marahunakura Irrigation, in a precarious position. The base data for all of the Schedule 10A.4 metrics is the take, which is the litres per second. The massaging of the flow record is arbitrary and shows little understanding of hydraulics. It does not consider in any way why high flows, for example, may occur. In the case of Strathclyde, these occur regularly during the frost fighting season when the flow rate is about 33 times greater than the flow rate during normal irrigation. There needs to be expert interpretation of the flow data for any analysis, not an application of arbitrary limits over an unrepresentative time range. A greater degree of quality assurance of the data is required. The annual volume determined for the five-year period 2005-16 to 2019-20 does not include any higher demand seasons. The seasons are predominantly low percentile demand seasons, less than the 50 percentile. The selection of this period is poorly conceived and will provide irrigators and water supply companies like Manuhurikia with a low degree of reliability. Strathclyde is an excellent demonstration of the appropriate approach to reliability and certainty of take and use. They recognised that the allocation, their 75.62 litres a second, was not sufficient to meet irrigation demand for 237 hectares of vineyard and for frost fighting. The latter is crucial to the vineyard. Without water to fight frost, there would be no grapes to harvest in most years. The proactive approach of Strathclyde to build storage to supplement irrigation demand and for frost fighting is the facilitation ORC should be taking to adopt to water allocation, and which has been and is adopted elsewhere.
Dr. Davin, I have some additional supplementary questions to address to you. So I think when you prepared your brief of evidence, you made the criticisms of the schedule as it was notified that you've just outlined in your summary, and you favour in the body of your evidence an approach where demand reliability is taken into account in determining monthly and annual volumes. Is that correct?
That's correct, particularly for annual volumes.
Yes. that demand reliability was based on, in your evidence, a 9 out of 10 year demand scenario.
That's correct.
So, since preparing this evidence, have you reflected further on how water availability could be appropriately accommodated for Strathclyde and others, reasoning for or taking historical data as the starting point?
Yes, I have.
Where do you get to with your reflections in that regard?
Firstly, that all of the years of record should be used for any analysis, not a selected five-year period. The use of averaged data takes away the actual volumes you need to meet the 90% of demand.
So, if you were to make those two adjustments to the schedule, what would that do to the availability of water for Strathclyde?
If we were to adopt what came out of the primary sector caucusing, and we were to use maximum values that had been recorded over the period of from all of the years of record, that would ease the concerns I had with the way in which the schedule was had been developed, and it would capture the reliability year that growers need to have to be able to run a viable operation. And in the case of someone like Strathclyde and other people who use water for frost fighting, it would also capture those volumes that are required, which are much, much greater than you need for irrigation.
Yes, thank you. So, can I just turn to the body of your brief of evidence again? You have attached to your brief of evidence some appendices, in particular a map, Appendix 1, and a further map showing the vineyard planted area, Appendix 2. And you've listened to the questions that my learned friend in the court have asked about the extent of established infrastructure on the vineyard. Are you able to, using those maps, identify what infrastructure is in place?
If I just start with Appendix 2 rather than Appendix 1, I'd just like to clarify that, just sort of what happens to the water when it arrives at MacArthur Ridge. In Appendix 2, I have a map that shows where the takeoff pond is, where the bottom pond is, and where the top pond is. In the body of my evidence, it tells you how big these are. You know, off the top of my head, I remember what the takeoff pond is. It's about 25,000 cubic metres. So water is then pumped from the takeoff pond to the bottom pond, and it's pumped from the takeoff pond to the top pond. The bottom pond is used exclusively for frostfighting. The top pond provides all the water for irrigation. So the irrigation infrastructure is established around the top pond, and it supplies water above and below to the vineyard blocks. And the bottom pond both ponds actually have large diesel pumps which are separate to the irrigation pumps, because when we're fighting a frost here, we're pumping 3,000 litres a second, which might not mean very much to people, but 3,000 litres a second is an awful amount of water to put through pipes. So the infrastructure is very different for fighting frost. And in fact, at the moment, the irrigation needs somewhere around about 170, 175 litres a second to be able to fully irrigate the planted area. So that infrastructure is there. So if you refer back then to Appendix 1, the areas that, and Mr. Rasmussen this afternoon may be able to identify these more clearly. I should also point out that I've worked on this vineyard since about 2005, I think. We had monitored soil moisture on this vineyard in a number of locations, so have wandered across this vineyard quite a lot. The areas that aren't developed are up around where blocks 1, 4, 2, 3, and I think 9 are. But all of the block sizes are already determined. So when the design was carried out for MacArthur Ridge development, all the block sizes were predetermined and sized, and all the pipework that has been installed so that they can cater for the demand, for the water demand that's required, the flow that's required for all these blocks. So, there is, it's not shown on any of these maps, but for the extra 54 hectares that is to be planted, there is also the requirement for another pond in the upper part of the vineyard. That's to the left-hand side of the vineyard, the western side of the vineyard, because there is insufficient water stored to be able to fight frost in the area that's unplanted at this stage. I don't have a plan of all the pipework. I'm sorry. Someone in MacArthur Ridge Estate somewhere will have a plan of what the pipe sizes and that are there, but they will be large pipes. We're talking probably 200 to 250 millimetre diameter pipes, and they'll be probably somewhat larger for frost fighting.
So just so that we're clear, the additional 50-odd hectares that are still planned to be planted are in areas 1, 2, 3, 4 and 9, as you understand.
Yeah, somewhere up in that sort of region. Yep.
Yep. And do you understand that those areas are serviced by existing horizontal infrastructure?
Yeah, the existing horizontal infrastructure. When you set out to design a vineyard of this size, or any vineyard or any operation this size, the last thing you want to do is go back and try and connect back into mainline that is already existing in the ground and then extend it to where you want it to go. The plan was to develop the whole 237 hectares. You put in your major pipework to be able to service those areas at the start, and then you can go back and tee off from there to do all your above ground work.
Yes, thank you. Just remain there, Dr. Davern, and answer any questions that the court or my learned friend may have.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good morning, Dr. Davern. Just staying with the infrastructure, perhaps if I can take you to your appendix two, the takeoff pond is indicated on that diagram. Is the takeoff pond gravity fed from the irrigation race?
Yes, it is. And it's fed from just through a gate, and there's a photograph in my evidence of the gate that feeds directly into the pond.
Yep. Is there any metering between the irrigation race and that pond?
No, there's not. So it is effectively, though, a rectangular weir. So it's a rectangular box, and it is check gauged by the raceman. So he does check gaugings on it to ensure that the opening on the gate is only allowing that three heads of water into the pond.
As far as you're aware, is there any requirement in relation to the contractual arrangements with the Manahitakea Irrigation Company to meter the takes from take points?
No, not as far as I'm aware.
So water is gravity fed down to the takeoff pond, and then is it gravity fed to the bottom pond, or is the bottom pond uphill?
No, it's pumped to the bottom pond and pumped to the top pond. That's my understanding. It's because in the body of my evidence, I've got the pumps that are at each of those locations.
Now, you mentioned, as you were discussing the horizontal infrastructure, the difference in flow requirements as between frost fighting and irrigation. And I recall the irrigation demands something in the order of 175 litres per second versus 3,000 litres per second for frost fighting. Is the frost fighting system running through different pipes? Is that a separate standalone system, or is it the same set of irrigation mains, if that makes sense?
No, my understanding is it's a separate set of... because as Dr. Jordan talked about, you're not sending water to three or four blocks at a time. You're sending water to the entire vineyard at the same time. So we're pumping water here at about 5.5 millimetres an hour. Five and a half millimetres an hour, so that you can fight down to about -5, -6 degrees. And that requires a very large pipe to be able to pump 3,000 litres a second around the vineyard. So there are, from memory, I think there's about 5 or 6 diesel pumps that do the frost fighting, and they're feeding into a separate main lines.
So is it your understanding that the frost fighting main line that was put in back in 2002 to 2004...
Yes, when I first went to the vineyard, both of these ponds and the frost fighting infrastructure was there, because the vines were already established when we got there to start measuring soil moisture. So I can only talk from about that 2005 period on when we started at the vineyard. And that infrastructure was there.
And in relation to that infrastructure, as I look at your Appendix 1, is it your understanding that the frost fighting... The frost fighting main will be accessible from each of those lots which are shown on your Appendix 1.
Yes.
So, separate to the frost fighting system, there's then a separate standalone system for the irrigation?
Yes, that's my understanding.
And are there then separate irrigation mains which have already been installed for the entirety of the property?
Yes, and the takeoffs for each of those blocks exist.
So can you just describe to me what the takeoff looks like? Is there an above-ground point?
Yeah, there'll be a T in the main line which then brings a riser to the surface, and that will be capped at the moment so that it's there ready to go when they develop those blocks.
So then in terms of that last phase of the development, it's been described as the above-ground infrastructure, the laterals, which are installed that essentially would be a valve block with the laterals running off it from somewhere above ground?
Yes, I'm not 100% sure that the wiring is in for the control valves. There'll be a solenoid there that will turn those on and off. It would be unusual that the main line has been put in and there's no control wiring going to those areas. There may be a separate sub-main that will be put in. The final design of each of those blocks in terms of where the above-ground laterals get connected is probably not quite decided. It's just we just know that that's the flow that's needed for those blocks. So there will be some minor underground stuff to go in, but the big stuff is there ready to go.
You mentioned that a further storage pond would be required for frost fighting purposes for the undeveloped sections. Is that shown on the map, or is there a clear understanding as to where that needs to go?
There's a clear understanding of where it's going. It's not shown on the map, but if you go to Appendix 1, my understanding is that it's somewhere up around just to the west of Block 12. And Mr. Rasmussen will be able to give you that precise location.
When you think about the infrastructure that might be required for that pond to be established, will further horizontal pipes be required?
I can't answer that question. I don't know.
Insofar as you have a storage pond for frost-fighting water, would you consider that horizontal pipes connected to that pond would be necessary for the additional area?
There'll have to be some pipes of some form either there or to be installed to be able to supply the flow at the rate that you need to be able to fight the frost.
I asked you a question about whether there was any metering in place between the takeoff and the takeoff pond, and you indicated there wasn't a meter in place, but I do understand there to be meters in place on the various pumps around the property. Is that correct?
Yes. The diesel pumps for frost fighting are not water metered, but all the irrigation water and the water that is transferred, if water is transferred from the bottom pond to the top pond, is water metered.
How are the ponds constructed in terms of, do they have a liner on them?
Can't answer that question.
When you are calculating the volumes of water required for frost fighting, in the absence of metering on the pumps, how do you undertake that exercise?
Oh, well, the pumps will be... There'll be a volume of water that's available for frost fighting. There'll still be some water coming in from the race to there, and so each of the pumps is a constant discharge pump, and it will be delivering X litres a second to X number of blocks, and they'll just add another bunch of diesel pumps. And they go to diesel pumps because they can't risk any electrical failure during frostfighting.
When you're looking at the historic records for frostfighting, how do you go about calculating the maximum values. Is that information you're having to reconcile based on pump capacities?
Well, your starting point is that is figuring out what degree of frost you're going to fight, and as Dr. Jordan discussed, the length of time you might have to fight that frost. And in, you know, rule of thumb is about one millimetre an hour per degree of frost that you want to fight. And if you want to fight 5.5 degrees, then you need to be able to supply 5.5 millimetres per hour across the entire block, and you can work, and you work backwards from that. And then you work out what your pump requirements will be to actually deliver that water to the various blocks.
So in a sense, you can calculate, working backwards, the volume that you might have taken if you know the area, the rate of application and the number of hours of application.
That's right.
Now, I understand from my learned friend's supplementary questions this morning that you are relatively content with the version of Schedule 10A4 that has progressed through conferencing to date.
I would say relatively, not entirely, but relatively. The fact that we've reached agreement that the maximums are what will be used captures the reliability and captures that additional water that's required for frost fighting in this case.
Now, one of the other changes recommended by the technical experts related to the water years that could be used for the calculation, and the recommendation was that all available water years be used. You may have seen that the council planner has expressed some concerns with using future water years in relation to water permits that perhaps don't expire with the deemed permits, but that may run through to 2025. So if the water permits that run through to that period of time are able to be exercised to their maximum rates in this future period of time, that will have a bearing on what the historical use from those permits would be calculated to be.
That's correct.
When you think about risks associated with the shift to maxima as opposed to averaging, do you accept that a shift to maxima means that the ability to influence historic records is easier than relying on averaging?
Sorry, just rephrase that question.
Yeah, easier wasn't a great word. when you think about the shift to maxima, it's essentially a one-off take that you might point to in a data record as providing a maximum rate of take.
That's correct.
Whereas if you are using averages of maxima across years, the one-off spikes might be reduced somewhat by the averaging mechanism.
That's true, but by using the averages, then you will take out the high demand requirements of some particular months and some particular years.
And so if you think about the future period of time, there might be an opportunity for abstractors to influence those maximum rates through a one-off take event if future years' data can be used.
I think there's an assumption there that they would use the water, would set out to deliberately use the water inefficiently, and I don't agree that's what people are out there trying to do.
Do you accept that with the shift to maxima, there is a risk if the date period includes future dates?
There's a risk, but I think you could also put in place some mitigation for those risks.
Isn't one of the mitigations that you might put in place simply capping the data period at June 2020 and looking backwards from that point in time?
No, I don't agree with that. I think if there's reliable water meter data and the water can be shown to have been used efficiently, then that data should be used.
And the schedule doesn't have any requirement at the moment to demonstrate that water has been used efficiently, does it?
No, it doesn't.
In terms of the... Let's go back a step. Are you familiar with the drafting that the planners have done following on from the joint witness conferencing?
Yes.
You'll see that some suggestions have been made in relation to the matter of discretion in relation to the restricted discretionary activity in terms of using other relevant methods and data. Is it your understanding that the restricted discretionary activity pathway is still only to be used in circumstances where those other methods and data reflect historical use?
If I can phrase that a little differently, I see the controlled activity pathway as a means of turning what is a troublesome set of deemed permits and mining privileges into RMA consents. If you do not have a data record that allows you to do that, then you have to take another pathway. And if it happens to be that restricted discretionary or some other pathway, then that's the path you will have to follow.
And in relation,
you will have missed the opportunity because the data isn't good enough or doesn't exist to be able to go down the controlled activity pathway.
Is it your understanding that that exercise is still to be carried out through the lens of reflecting historical use?
My understanding from the caucusing that I attended, that the historical use was not part of the restricted discretionary activity.
Is that reflected in the joint witness statement that was produced by the primary sector?
Yes. If you did not have a verified water meter record or water flow record, then you would have to take another pathway. So you weren't able to enter the controlled activity pathway.
Might be helpful that Dr. Daveron refers to the part in the technical schedule that says that.
Yes.
Yep. Do you have the technical schedule with you? Oh, the technical JWS.
Yep. Mm. From the primary sector?
Yeah.
Yep. Just bear with me and I'll drag it up. So you just have to bear with me while I cruise through here. I think it's in the intent of paragraph 17.
Well, as I read paragraph 17, it reflects an understanding that water meter data should be used to demonstrate the historical take and use of water.
Yep. And 16 says that the starting point for the data required for Schedule 10A is flow rate data that is consistent with the current infrastructure of the system at the point of take.
And so when you think about the restricted discretionary activity pathway where a complete data record may not be available, it's your understanding that the methods used to calculate rates of take and volumes is to be reflective of historical use.
At the primary witness conferencing, we discussed that in the absence of a record that you could use, that a way forward might be that you could look at the infrastructure, the irrigation infrastructure that was there, and that would provide you with a pretty good estimate of what the flow would be required to run that infrastructure, and that could be a starting point. But that was not part. That had to be outside of the controlled activity pathway.
From my reading of the joint witness statement, it doesn't really get into that issue in any great detail.
No, there was general agreement at the start of it that we were looking for a way in which people could enter and get through the controlled activity pathway. If you couldn't get into that pathway, then you had to renew, or you had to turn your deemed permit into a consent via another pathway. It was made pretty clear to us at the conference, and we were there to sort out issues around the controlled activity pathway.
Whether I might pick your brain a little now based on your knowledge and experience of irrigation systems for uses other than viticulture. So today we've heard some useful evidence in relation to the horizontal infrastructure requirements for the MacArthur Ridge development. I'd be interested to understand, based on your experience, whether you see or have witnessed other irrigation developments which are done in a similar staged manner, where what might be described as the necessary horizontal pipes are all laid for a property very early on, but the above ground infrastructure hasn't been completed?
Yeah, look, I've seen a number of particularly centre pivot type operations, particularly now in more recent times, centre pivot schemes that are going to be put in where the horizontal infrastructure in this case includes not just the mainline pipe that goes in, but the cable, the electric cable that goes in, because if you're putting one in, you put both in. So they will be taken to the points at which the next pivots will be designed. The concrete pads will have been poured at those points so that you can actually bring those two things to the surface on a concrete pad. Very common for that to happen in multi-pivot operations where you know, you get, especially if you're coming out of raw ground, so to speak, you'll get one or two going and then progressively develop as time goes on.
So with that development scenario in mind, you would see the pumps and the irrigation main lines sized for the full extent of the development?
Yes, certainly the main lines and at least one of the pumps will be designed ready to supply the water for all of the development ultimately. Because these days you'll have VSD, variable speed control, in the pump sheds, so that you can send the right amount of water to each of the pivots, so that when you want to run at full noise, you'll just adjust your VSD to send all that water to all of the irrigation systems that you want to run.
And in your experience, what have you observed as being the period of time over which that type of development might take place?
Of the order of 2 to 5 years.
When you think about the level of investment required, I have in mind this scenario where centre pivots are being used, what's the proportion of cost above ground versus below ground?
Oh, about 50-50.
And have you been involved in any particular irrigation design and development programs within the Otago region where that scenario you know to exist?
No.
So that scenario was dealing with what I conceptually understand as being fixed infrastructure. You may describe it using a different word, but conceptually I understand a pivot, there's at least a fixed point. And there are some other irrigation systems which are perhaps less efficient where they aren't perhaps considered as fixed. So travelling guns, rotor owners, those sorts of systems. What type of horizontal infrastructure might you see associated with those types of systems?
Oh, I think for the most part, if you want to irrigate a block of land, and just take for argument's sake, you want to irrigate 200 hectares, and it's going to be irrigated by those types of systems, then you would lay the horizontal infrastructure for those irrigators right at the beginning. And you may have the hydrants at the surface ready to be able to connect to. As I said before, the last thing you want to do is to part build the system and then have to come back and dig it up and reconnect pipes and carry on to the next extent. Unless you buy another block of land next door, then that's a different story. But if you're starting out to irrigate 200 hectares, you'll have a design that's going to provide water for that 200 hectares, and you'll set up that base infrastructure to get that done. It would be unusual to have a I think it would be unusual in my experience to find a travelling irrigator system that is part-built. If they're going to irrigate 200 hectares with a travelling irrigation system, it will be installed complete.
So those types of system, in your experience, aren't ones which are progressively developed, given the ease of shifting your travelling irrigator around?
Yep. Yeah, my experience is that those travelling irrigation systems are built in their entirety right from the beginning.
So when we're thinking about this question of stranded capital, it's not really that situation that's presenting the greatest challenge.
No. I think the greatest challenge with stranded infrastructure is more likely in the horticultural industry, the wider horticultural industry where you have small blocks within a large block that you know, you get partly developed and then maybe commodity prices don't quite work out, and you might not want to plant the rest in grapes, you might want to put it into cherries or something else later on down the track. When you're broadacre irrigating, except for centre pivots, anything that's travelling, I think you'll find is going to be built in its entirety right from the beginning.
So when we're thinking about this question of stranded capital, the greatest risks, horticulture, and do you include viticulture as a subset of horticulture?
Yeah, I include viticulture in the horticultural centre. Yeah.
And we heard some evidence from Mr Webb last week in relation to the Webb orchards and the development program there. Is it your experience that there's a longer lead time in relation to horticulture type activities?
Yeah, a lot of what you might want to plant is not immediately available. Dr. Jordan can probably clarify that more than I can, but you know, you can't just go out and get 10,000 Pinot Noir on some rootstock tomorrow. They take years to produce at the nursery.
Yes. No, thank you. No further questions.
Any questions? No. All right. Any re-examination?
No.
I just had a series of random questions, which I need to close out. So at paragraph 16 of the technical joint witness statement, so that's the conference that you attended. It was an interesting paragraph that I've overlooked. I've just got to get it back into the statement.
Yep.
So that says all witnesses agree that the starting point for data required for the schedule is the flow rate data that's consistent with the current irrigation infrastructure of the system at the point of take. And so one of the issues that have come up with the removal of the dates, bookending the relevant period, is that you could capture a period where there was a different irrigation system in place, perhaps something inefficient, like a border dike. But by the time you come to seek your replacement consent, in fact, you've got a more efficient system in the ground. So is that, given what you say at paragraph 16, is that a matter that needs to be brought forward into the a matter of control or a matter of discretion, depending on which rule it lands, but it needs to be brought forward so it's taken into account?
Something that we didn't consider, actually.
This is on the basis that your maximum shouldn't be a border dike if now you're a centre pivot.
That's true. well, I think without going back to caucusing again, but something that we did not... It wasn't something that we actually really considered, that there would be... We'd converted from border dike to spray irrigation, for example. If I was making my personal, from my own personal expertise, I would be saying that this would be what you currently have. So you might only have 5 years of record, and that's what you've got at the moment, and that's what's needed to supply your current irrigation system. You're not going to turn back the clock and go back to, for example, border dike irrigation.
Right, okay.
That 5 year period or whatever it would be would very unlikely contain the years that would give you the reliability data that you might need to operate. In which case you would then have to decide whether you want to continue down that controlled activity pathway or
take a different route.
Yep.
All right, so that the data used has to be data relevant to the current irrigation system, not some...
That's certainly the intent of this.
That was what the intent was, but that's helpful. And then, you know, Mr. Moore also asked you questions about the other part of the bookend, that is the future date, that's now been removed as well. And you said, well, in relation to a ramping risk, there are other mitigations measures that you could take, and I'm wondering if you could just round that out. What are the other mitigation measures you could take when looking at data which could be ramp data, or checking to see if the data is in fact reflecting a period of ramping?
I think there's, people would have to ramp, would have to turn up with some evidence that they used the water wisely and efficiently, so that that would require them to have some soil moisture monitoring, for example, that in place to show that they didn't just turn the irrigation on and keep going. That they have in this day and age where we have, I know they don't exist so much in particularly in the Otago region, but in terms of a farm environmental plan, for example, these days that there is evidence that you have used that water efficiently and in all ways, that you have a system that applies water uniformly and efficiently, and you can show that you've got some objective evidence that you did not use the water inefficiently. And I think the best evidence you can have for that is a soil moisture record that shows that you irrigated when you needed to and in the amounts that were required.
And so, in terms of bringing to account that objective information to dispel or to ground truth that there has not been ramping, that may be, if you eliminate again the water, the water years 2015 to 2020, that may need to be brought to account in a controlled activity rule and also the RDA rule, the objective evidence. That's information that you should be required to produce at the same time to prove either historical or whatever we're doing in the RDA space.
Yeah, look, I think the number of people that historically have been measuring soil moisture...
It's not many.
It's few.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at all the surveys that have been done of irrigators who have some sort of objective means of determining when they irrigate hasn't changed very much in 30 years, 35, 40 years. It's somewhere around about 18 to about 20%.
So it's unlikely to be that source of information.
I think the people that have set out in this process and have in the Otago area, and I know a number of these people, they have taken all the right options. They've water metered their use. They've measured soil moisture. They've done a whole lot of things to ensure that they face the best possible chance of getting the water that they have been using historically. Mm.
And yet it's recorded in Professor Skelton's report, or reported by Professor Skelton, ramping behaviour leading up to applications for resource consent.
I have no doubt that that occurs.
No doubt that that occurs. And actually other witnesses have said so as well. So how do you test... how do you test whether the data that you're putting forward is indeed?
I think you could. I think it would require a lot of work, but you could go back to using something like the AquaLink
method. Because then you would ground truth the data against reasonable.
And then you could say, a reasonable use in this year would have been around about this number.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Irrecalc or the AquaLink method tends to probably overestimate the volume that's actually required.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody has exceeded that volume in that year, there has to be some explanation.
Mm.
And the council has that ability to ask the questions.
Mm.
So I think there are other means that we can look at. And that's not the only model around that could be used to do that. There are models around that can that besides ERICALC model, you can use SPASMO or a number of other models that you could test whether those volumes that were used were reasonable in that particular year. And you could, for want of a better, catch out the rampers.
Right, because just looking at the irrigation, the sizing of the irrigation infrastructure itself, particularly the main line, or maybe even the laterals, that's not going to tell you much, because if you're ramping, you're ramping under that irrigation system.
Yeah, what it does, though, is that once you've got an irrigation system in place, it can't pump any more water
than that.
That if you're going to send a pivot and it's using 50 litres a second, if you put 80 litres a second into it, it'll cut out on high pressure. It just won't work.
Right, okay.
So there's a limit to what they can do. That means they have been using water inefficiently. So your ramping gets caught out on the volume that you use because it's being used at a time when rainfall would have otherwise satisfied the demand.
But these methods to test or verify use... are matters that could be usefully explored, given that there is a real risk and you've acknowledged there's a risk. There are matters that could be explored as part of the information requirements in a conference. Would that be fair?
Yep.
Okay. Also, you said... So in relation to this farm that we have before us, they've got two main lines. They've got a frost fighting main line and an irrigation main line. But you were not sure whether or not an additional main line had to go to connect a storage pond, which is yet to be constructed.
I'm not... That storage pond that is to be constructed, my understanding of that pond is that it's for frost fighting.
I'm not bothered about the storage pond at all. I'm just bothered about
I'm unsure that there is... I'm sure about the irrigation pipeline that's there for irrigating those blocks.
Yeah.
I'm unsure whether there's a main line there to supply that water for frost fighting.
Okay. So...
Because there won't be any pumps there, you see.
No.
And they'll be connected to that main line.
Okay. I'm just concerned that the addition of the pond and a frost fighting mainland associated with that new pond... not preclude MacArthur under the current draft of the policy policy and rules. And so when we're looking at, you know, what is the level of in-ground commitment, is it that everything be built, including, you know, the fifth pond or the fourth pond plus mainline, or can we describe the development as in-ground development as being effectively completed by what? Irrigation mainline, frost fighting mainline. How do you describe when it's effectively completed? Because there's a small element of this development which is not in ground, not built.
I would be satisfied that the intent to develop 234 hectares was there because the irrigation mainline and the infrastructure associated with that mainline is in place. The design is, there's no question it was designed. All the blocks are laid out. We know how many litres a second are going to go to each of those blocks. So the intent was there to actually fully develop this into another 54 hectares of Pinot Noir. The fact that they now realise they need to have another pond for frost fighting has probably come out of, and I don't know exactly, but will have come out of the fact that they have had some frosts where they have effectively run out of water in the ponds.
All right.
And they know that the two ponds that they've got are not sufficient to deal with the next 54 hectares.
So, again, if you take this matter of control back and now it's being administered by a baby planner at the regional council who's not familiar with this hearing process.
Yeah.
What is he or she to take of this? Are they going to kick you out because you've got a frost fighting mainline which is required to go to a storage pond? You know, so what should we be looking at? Should we be looking for the irrigation mainline, the frost fighting mainline, or both? Or what?
The key is the irrigation mainline.
Irrigation mainline. Okay. All right.
Okie dokie.
So why is that? Why is the key the irrigation mainline when you're equally using water and a lot of it for frostbiting on occasions?
Because when this vineyard was designed, it was designed for 237 hectares. You know how much water's got to go. You know right from the beginning what your flow rates have got to be able to irrigate those, because you have much greater knowledge about the requirements of the grapes in terms of their water requirement and the flow rates that you need to actually irrigate those individual blocks. What you don't know is what they didn't know. And I'm just putting words into their mouths in a way. But what you don't know, the greater uncertainty is how big a frost are you having to fight for, how long, and what's their frequency during the worst of the seasons. And I suspect that they have found that I know that they nearly ran out of water in 2016 fighting an autumn frost. The ponds were effectively just about empty. And the Falls Dam was, I think in that year, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in 2016 the Falls Dam was very low, didn't have enough water. They ran the gauntlet of fighting a frost to save the crop. If there'd been another frost, helicopters would have had to come in. We've already heard from Dr. Jordan that there isn't enough inversion in this area to fight a frost with helicopters. So I think they've figured out that. They need another volume of water stored, ready to go for fighting frost.
Mm. All right, so then the test for the level of infrastructure development is around the known knowns, which is the irrigation demand,
yes.
Demand for water by the particular crop, yep. In these circumstances.
Yeah. Right. And these are unique.
Mm.
I mean, you know, if this is a pastoral situation and it's a centre pivot development, you're not fighting frost.
No.
But would you for orchards?
Well, it would be for an orchard, and the same thing would apply for webs. They've got storage.
Mm.
I was troubled by the word unique. It's a word that's often
well,
used,
I think,
so I was
I
trying to understand what you meant.
Yeah, I think
that.
When we're having to fight frost to save your crop and save your livelihood, then that sort of puts it in my mind in a little bit of a unique situation. We're not just using this water for irrigation.
Okay. Right. And when you're thinking frost fighting here in Cromwell, are you thinking unique in the sense that there is an inversion layer, and that's catabatic winds, and is that right?
Well, your inversion occurs because you get heat rising and it sits up there at about 20 feet or 30 feet, and you've got to somehow get it down and spread it around the orchard or the vineyard.
Inversions aren't particularly uncommon around the country, though, are they?
Sorry?
Well, the inversion layer is not uncommon around the country. You live in Christchurch, probably above
I mean, look, you know, you go into places like Waipara, most of the frost fighting there is using frost fans to pull the inversion down, and if not using them, they're using helicopters.
Yeah, yeah.
Go to Marlborough when there's a frost and there's a couple of hundred helicopters flying around the place.
Mm. Anyway,
sorry,
I understand that your thinking is it's the irrigation mainline, because that's the known, and that's what's going to demonstrate what needs to be demonstrated if assets are not to be stranded. Frost fighting can be planned, but can also be upscaled, as has happened on the MacArthur as well. Okay. I was interested in your comment that... Where is it? I was interested in your comment that the controlled activity rule provides a pathway to turn the troublesome deemed permits into RMA consents, is what you said. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on the troublesome deemed permits and...
Well, I've always considered them a bit of a troublesome thing because they they started out not as an irrigation consent, but started out as something that was granted so that you could sluice gold, and and the fact that the infrastructure just happened to be there in terms of races, and then you know, once the glory of gold disappeared, then along came horticulture in the terms of orchards, and if you look around, a lot of them, you know, the race was running right past the block of land that you wanted to you know. And I don't know the whole history of how these things ended up being granted out as irrigation consents, but they were there. And well, we've known, I mean, you know, without being critical, we've known for a long time that these deemed permits or mining privileges needed to be turned into RMA consents. Probably known that since 1992, I guess. And they're troublesome now because we've reached 2021 and they're still not converted into RMA consents.
So that's where I
have my troublesome things, you know.
Right. And those deemed permits come with a right of priority. Are you familiar with the rights of priority?
Yeah. I don't want to go there.
You don't want to go there?
No.
Okay, fine. All right. Okay, so...
We don't want any pistols drawn here.
So rights... I'm going to go there. Because I understand rights of priority, where they exist for permit holders on the same tributary or the same main stem, are a flow-sharing regime for the benefit of abstractors on that water body. Would that be one way of regarding them? There's no environmental outcome here. It's flow sharing as between abstractors.
Well,
is that fair?
You know, we do that everywhere else in New Zealand. So, you know, look, flow sharing's a very sensible, pragmatic approach to dealing with people continuing to get access to water when you're heading towards a minimum flow. And we need to remember a lot of these places don't even have minimum flows.
Yeah, that's right.
But there's nothing unusual about flow sharing.
No.
And it is a solution to everybody retaining access to some water. I mean, eventually you reach a point where the access to that water, the amount of water you get is pretty much useless. Unless you just stick it in a pond. Because you can't you end up not being able to run your irrigators or your system because the flow rate's not high enough. But it's a pragmatic solution. And it's well proven.
And in terms of your clients, have your do your clients hold deemed permits? Do you have experience of how they exercise those rights or not?
I've only ever had one client that actually
had one,
had a deemed permit. And there was no flow sharing.
No.
And so his neighbour had priority over the water, and he was left without.
Okay.
He did have another backup source.
Yeah.
And it was in the, you know, it was in the Maniototo. So,
And so what did his neighbour do? Just tell him to shut down when the...
When he, you know, when he needed the... When he needed to take his full four heads. And there was... That's all that was left in the in the river, then, or the stream, then that's it. You know, eventually he runs out of water too, because all these deemed permits, most of these things run out of water eventually.
Is that because they're in drying reaches or drying rivers or
No, I mean, generally there's more water allocated under with deemed permits than there's flow in the river eventually.
Well, if it was the water be taken up, I understand that to be the case, All right. So as imperfect as that example of your client is, there was... an allocation of water determined by the rights of priority as between your client and his neighbour. Would that be fair?
Yep.
Yeah. But the controlled activity doesn't replace those rights as between neighbours.
No.
And we don't have a plan, as I understand it, with the regional water plan that actually has sets minimum flows and allocation limits for all water bodies. That'll be correct?
That's my understanding.
And the controlled activity or even RDA will not be doing that either if there's no minimum flows or allocation limits. Yeah. So a flow sharing agreement as between neighbours might, if they've entered into one.
Yep.
Yep. But if they haven't, then your client remains exposed.
That's right.
Yes. And so what do you think about, do you, have you given any thought as to how this might, plan might speak into that?
No, this was something that ended up in High Court and it's
okay.
been resolved.
Yep.
The place has been sold. So.
Okay, that's
yep.
okay.
So, yep.
Yep, yep, yep.
So, no, I haven't given any thought to that.
Mm. Would it be fair to say, I mean, I'm assuming that you know about the Manahita Kia Incorporated Society and the shares that it sells in the society to other entities, and I'm not sure whether they're just individual farmers or whether they're all irrigation schemes. Can you comment about that? The shares, do they go to... a farm, or do
well,
they,
the scheme is the scheme is the Manahita Kia scheme,
yeah.
which has a rough command area.
Yeah,
not like we have in Canterbury, where mm. you know where you have a command area that's very defined,
mm.
And you can't go outside that without getting a consent
yeah.
change. But there's a rough there's
a rough
command area.
Yeah.
And all of the water that's available, mm. my understanding is that all the water that's available is allocated.
Mm. And so Strathclyde, which is an irrigation company, what is Strathclyde then? So you've got Manahita Kia, which is an incorporated society. The incorporated society itself has a command area which it's conveying water to,
yeah.
and Strathclyde is taking off on at some point of...
Yep.
that conveyance, and then it distributes
yep.
to its people.
And so Strathclyde is sort of another level of multi-ownership.
Yeah.
A lot of the other entities that I'm familiar mm-hmm. with on the Manahita Kia scheme are individual orchards and mm. vineyards that
okay.
are taking water. So they have an allocation. They will have bought some land that had a mining privilege attached to it.
Mm.
So... in my understanding at Strathclyde is that block of land was bought and it had three heads of water attached,
mm.
Allocated for that
yeah.
block of land.
So which is what
their right of take is.
So does that
heads.
Always have to be the case that in the case of Strathclyde it needed to have had its own allocation under permits? Or is it the case that Manahita Kia Irrigation Company is the permit holder?
I can't answer that question. You'd have to ask somebody that is more involved in the uh-huh. Manahita Kia and the Strathclyde.
Okay.
But my understanding was that when the block of land that was bought,
mm.
there was available an allocation of three mm. heads of water for that 200. Well, mm. it's actually more than 237 hectares. It's
mm.
a much bigger area than that. But that block of that title of land had an
mm.
had an allocation that was three heads of water.
Yes, but yeah, okay. So I'm a little unclear now, but it's probably not material as to whether or not MacArthur's irrigating using an allocation from deemed permits held by Strathclyde. Or deemed permits held by the Manahita Kia Irrigation?
No, the deemed permits that are held by Manahita Kia.
Pardon? By the deemed permits held by Manahita
Kia? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, no, that's
yeah.
fine. All right. And those deemed permits held by Manahita Kia, we've heard about one is in relation to the Falls Dam. Do we know the other deemed permits, are they all from that source, or are they up and down the breadth of the river?
I don't know. I don't. Know the details of that, sorry.
All right. Falls Dam itself is a deemed permit or a resource consent under the RMA? You know, regular.
So it was built by the Ministry of Works, though, from
yep.
my understanding. Is that correct? Someone tell me. I think it was built by the Ministry of Works.
Okay.
Falls Dam.
All right.
Because that's when the Manahita scheme was
yep.
was developed. The Falls Dam
mm.
was built. It then had a number of deemed permits
mm.
that it could use to fill the dam,
mm-hmm.
and then used mostly existing water races to deliver the water.
Right. Okay, so the purpose of the question is just really to look at the exposure of or risk associated with deemed permits finally expiring on the 1st of October, and whether that risk is ameliorated by the share arrangements between water takers and Manahita Kea Irrigation Company, effectively providing a flow regime which overtakes, if you like, the deemed permits. Or a flow sharing agreement. I think they also call it the same thing. Again, effectively overtaking the deemed permits and the rights authority there to provide for a flow sharing arrangement between Marahia Kea Irrigation Co-op and its shareholders. So that's the area that.
I think you just miss a key point here, and that is that Falls Dam provides you with a big storage that gets you over the issue of those
deemed permits.
Those deemed permits.
Yeah.
They're using those deemed permits to
fill the dam. Yeah.
So that they can then provide a reliable source of water to all of their, for want of a better word, shareholders or whatever we want to call these people that are all part of the Manahura Kea scheme.
Yep.
It's very different to somebody that has a deemed permit that's on a stream for which there is no storage, or a number of people that are on a stream where there is, or there'll be streams. There won't be one of the major rivers that are on a stream where priority still exists, and they haven't come to some mutual arrangement where they can share the water.
Yeah. Okay, no, that's fine.
So they're very different.
They are very different scenarios, and each have a different risk profile, if you like, and that's really helpful. I think it's confirming my general understanding of what is going on. And those are my questions. Commissioner, have you got any questions?
I wanted to explore a little further. When you were answering questions in relation to testing reasonable use, you talked about Aqualink and then, was it Irrikalk?
Yeah.
Irrikalk.
I-R-R-I-C-A-L-C.
You know, I've written it correctly. I just thought it was an E at the end rather than a C, my poor writing. And then you said that in relation to those two approaches that it was known that the volume requirements were overstated. I wondered, one, what you meant by that, and two, what the basis of your observation was.
Yeah, so Irrikalk and Aqualink are effectively the same thing. Irrikalk is used to develop the Aqualink guidelines that the Regional Council has a report of for Otago. So Irrikalk is a theoretical model. So you're running a daily water balance and with some irrigation rules and some uniformity information and some information about the soils, and it models how much water will be used on a daily basis. You can set the length of the irrigation season so that in the case of if you were running it for the Manahura Kea scheme, for example, you would set it from the 7th of September to the something April. I can't remember what the date in April is, but that's the irrigation season, so it would not do any calculations outside of that period. So what is not included in this are the management decisions that somebody makes on the ground. So, and it assumes that everything, runs according to the theory. So in practice, when you go out in the field and see somebody that's got might have a 1 million cubic metre volume for a year, you generally find that they very rarely use that 1 million cubic metres if that's the 90% of demand season volume. because there's a whole lot of other factors that are going on. Something might break down. You decide not to irrigate for one reason or another. You're managing your irrigation very differently to the way in which the model works. So we know that all over New Zealand where the Irrigalc model has been used, that it tends to overstate the volume that growers need. So has
that been... can you quantify that at all, or is it...
It's more than anecdotal, but it's nobody sat down and done a quantitative, you know, study of what people are actually using. Although water meter records now are helping us show that, and particularly if you go into the Canterbury area, where water meter record, we've got really good water meter records on most of the really big takes since about 2011 or 12, and so if you look at those periods of record, we've had some 90% odd demand seasons in that period, and we've never used as much water as Irrigalc has. Not even on the big dairy farms have we used that much water. So we know that it sort of slightly overstates it. That's why I'm saying if somebody has far exceeded the volume that Irrigalc calculates in that particular season, then you have to be pretty sure that they're ramping the irrigation use.
So you're not by sceptical.
I'm very sceptical of somebody that does that. In fact, I think even if they get to the Irrigalc volume, I'd be going, man, you must have done some irrigation that you didn't need to do. I'd be looking pretty hard at it. Yep.
So then you talked about other models, and SPASMO was one that's been mentioned. I have heard that associated with horticultural activities in particular, but is it confined to that?
No. You can use it for anything. It's been used in Hawke's Bay for... Hawke's Bay Regional Council used it instead of Irrigalc to determine what the irrigation demands would likely to be for when the Ruatanaford irrigation dam and irrigation scheme was to be developed. So it was a Hort Research Steve Green model, and equally as good as and there are other daily water balance models around that you can use.
So I have been involved in a number of cases where there have been arguments about what models it was appropriate to use.
Yep.
And so, what is it you're really looking for here in terms of a selection of a model if you were...
Well, at the end of the day, you're probably arguing about pennies rather than dollars when you compare the models. They all have the same base operation. They are all running a daily water balance. It just depends on the finer intricacies that they apply to those models.
So if you weren't to be specifying an actual model name, what would be the objectives or the purpose of the models?
It would need to be a peer-reviewed model.
Yes, but in terms of the inputs and the outputs and what it is you're seeking to have demonstrated through that model, is there a simple way of describing that?
No, I think I think the fact that it's a peer-reviewed daily water balance model, I mean, I think from a scientific point of view, technical point of view, when you're talking about a daily water balance model, then there are some inherent characteristics about those models that if they weren't there wouldn't pass peer review scrutiny.
So what you're saying is a daily water balance model.
A daily water balance where you deal with what happens on a daily basis rather than for example, if you compared Overseer, which I'm sure you've heard of, doesn't run a daily water balance model. It has a crude assumption of a daily water balance model. And a daily water balance model deals in events. So it deals with rainfalls that have actually occurred historically on that particular day. And so you can determine then when much more precisely what the irrigation demand is likely to be.
Okay, so thank you for that. So I just want to be clear on another point, and that's this vexed question of broadening out the water years, which came out of the joint witness statement process. And I really want to understand the phrase for which water meter data is available, what that actually means. You know, what years might we be talking about for that, for a starter?
Yep. So if you go back to the water meter regulations of 2010, all takes that were greater than 20 litres a second were to be water metered. So we're probably not going to get too many records that are older than 2010. The really vigilant irrigators, I suppose, those that were really conscious of what they were using might have some water meter records that predate 2010, probably don't. Some of that record probably isn't very good and wouldn't pass scrutiny, probably wasn't verified. But the nice thing about the regulations in 2010 specified that the water meter records needed to be verified, and there were some standards set that you had to meet. And so if they have met those standards, then you've got a reliable record that you could use. And scientifically, technically, the longer your record, the better the answer that you're going to get. And in this case, when we're talking about irrigation demand for irrigators, we will cover a range of reliability seasons. We'll get that range from when you hardly have to irrigate to when you have to irrigate most of the season.
In terms of the maximum that
You cannot allocate water on the basis of the maximum, though. It might be the 100th percentile season. If you did that, then nobody would get water. There'd be very few people that had water. But you can live with a reliability of somewhere around 90%. So the 9 out of 10 year season has proven to be a reliable estimate of what irrigators need to be able to run their businesses.
So if you've got 2010 as the water metering date that you're speaking to, why wouldn't you specify that 2010 in terms of the one end of the limit?
I don't think we should prohibit any data that precedes 2010, so long as it meets those standards. If it's got a reliable water meter in there that may not have been verified, but it might be an electromagnetic meter, and it may have been verified soon after 2010, and it's shown to be precise, then why wouldn't we use any period of record? I just think the longer the period of record you can use, the better the result is going to be all over for everybody.
Well, I guess I just want you to take you back to the point which you reminded us about in terms of the joint witness statement, where you talked about basically the data needing to be consistent with the current infrastructure of the system at the point of take. So I don't see that reflected in the notion of for which water meter data is available as the controlled activity is currently written.
Well, if we take Strathclyde, for example, we could actually go back pre-2009. Because they water metered their data prior to that, and at the, right at the beginning they had 174 hectares of vineyard planted, so that data would reflect their current use as well.
Yes, but that might be unusual, mightn't it?
It probably is unusual, but I don't think you can preclude those irrigators that have been responsible and have been monitoring data for a long period of time.
Yes, but the point I'm asking about is the current infrastructure point. So I'm really saying if that's what it's about, shouldn't the data that you're looking at only relate to the current infrastructure and not go back to previous infrastructure that might have produced quite a different data set from what you're now considering?
Strathclyde's probably a little bit different because their infrastructure hasn't changed. Not since it was developed in 2004.
Yes, well, I understand, but do you understand
the point of
my question? I guess, I mean, I have had experience of hearing evidence on the change in historic takes that's a consequence of putting in new and efficient infrastructure and moving away from methods like border diking and wild flooding, and we've had evidence there's still a lot of that going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, so...
that statement in the joint witness statement, I guess is, you know, I guess what's implicit in that is that what is currently there now could have also been what was there in 2010 or 2012, but that if you have changed your system, then it's the period of record that you have for that current infrastructure.
Right.
Whether that be 1 year or 5 years or 15 years.
Okay. Look, thank you for that. That's been very helpful.
Actually, there was one more thing I wanted to ask you about. It just came up with the evidence with Lionel Hume from Federated Farmers yesterday, and he was proposing, off the top of his head, a RDA pathway which would be open, which would not increase the land under irrigation and would pertain to the existing land use, so it wouldn't be a change, say, from pasture to crops, it's existing land use. And he said an RDA pathway which allows a volume to be allocated based on an efficiency assessment. So I assume he means Aqualink because I know he's familiar with Aqualink. He said the advantage there would be is that here you're not talking about irrigators who've got in-ground infrastructure already built, but people who were in the process of improving irrigation efficiency by improving irrigation efficiency. It's not capturing those folk that are going to do those folk who, in order to get improved irrigation efficiency, also need to be taking more and irrigating more to pay it off. It's the same land area, same land use, an allocation based on irrigation efficiency, you know, reasonable use and demand. What do you think about that? Would that likely attract people who were transitioning to more efficient systems or not? By itself. He didn't say 6 years. I'm saying 6 years because I know that's in the RDA already.
Yeah, look, we did discuss that at the conferencing because, you've heard from Lionel and we know where his sympathies lie. I mean, I'm not sure that he entirely agrees with the controlled pathway thing either, because, you know, he's very much about efficiency and uniformity and farmers getting the right amount of water. I sympathise with that. Hang on, I've just got to think what I was going to say now. That option was there if somebody... somebody could decide, for example, that the control pathway is not for them, that they don't like the numbers that are coming out the other end. I don't know why they would choose that if they've got good records to work with. But they could then decide to go down the other pathway, which would then provide them with exactly what Lionel was talking about. I don't know that that's answered your question
to
me, though.
I guess his pathway were for people who have plans to develop irrigation infrastructure as opposed to, you know, the category that we're looking at here where the irrigation infrastructure is already in the ground. And he said that there was a group of people who would increase irrigation infrastructure, provided that they had the surety of an allocation based on reasonable use and demand, not an allocation based on hitherto historical. So they would go forward with those improvements. And to that limited extent, there would be or could be an improvement, some gain for the environment based on efficient use. But, you know,
that's fine.
Do you think that there would
be. But there has to be an allocation available to do that.
Yeah, there has to be an allocation available. Okay, so that's where you think that falls down. That
I mean,
it's all very well to say I'll have reasonable use and demand, but if there's no flow in the river, then you've got a problem. Yeah, okay.
Or if the groundwater is fully allocated, what can you do?
No, nothing. Okay. Okay, and so is that the difficulty moving from historical to a historical, you know, an allocation based on historical use for current irrigation systems to something which is now completely based on reasonable use and demand? So we are talking about replacement permits. He's not a newbie.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the only way around that is that there has to be, I mean, someone would have to store some water.
To be able to move, for
that to be able to be put in place,
there
may not be an allocation available, may not be any flow in the river, so what you've got to be able to do is then to be able to find another, you've got to be able to find an allocation to actually do that. It's all very well for that to be a pathway, but it may be entirely impractical because there isn't any water available to do it.
But this would be for replacement consents, existing permit holders or deemed permits, so they're to be replaced.
But they're looking to increase their irrigated... No, they're not looking to increase their
irrigated area.
Well, if they're looking to improve their irrigation system, then they should be actually using less water than what they are currently using.
Yeah. Oh, well, yes. Yes, they should. But he's saying for some people, they will only move towards that level of investment if they have the surety of volumes and rates based on an equivalent methodology or equivalent, as opposed to anything that this plan is seeking to do.
I don't have an issue with that, but at the end of the day, it still comes back to, is there an allocation for them to actually move in that direction? It might all be all very well to get a paper allocation, but if there is no water to be had, then, you know, they may be better to try and get down this controlled pathway and get some...
And does that indicate, then, that hesitancy indicate that if you're moving from historical use to reasonable demand, that there will be an increase in the total volume?
Yeah, if you move from... I think probably if you move from historical use, that, and you moved to that... for want of a better word, that aqualink volume, that the volume allocated will increase.
And why does it increase?
Because if you look at the deemed permit situation and this controlled activity, the irrigators on these schemes, they know how unreliable this water is because there's far too many deemed permits out there for the water that's available. So they've actually already shored themselves up with storage on farm. Just look around at all the storage dams, ponds that are around and the schemes that are developed. Last Chance, Manahurakea, there's, you know, they've all got, even if you go around these little places around Bannockburn, they've all got ponds to store water in because the scheme's unreliable. So they've already become very efficient users of the water. I think it's unfair to suggest that the users of these deemed permits, you know, except for perhaps they might have been border diking or they may have been, God forbid, randomly flood irrigating.
Doing that too.
You know, that's not, they're not bad irrigators, that's just how they actually did it. But if they've moved to more efficient systems now and they've actually they understand the unreliability and they've shored themselves up for that unreliability, moving to an Aqualink type allocation would mean paper wise a larger allocation. Probably doesn't answer your question. You're still asking.
No, it does.
So if I haven't built my irrigation infrastructure and I am wanting an allocation calculated by the Aqualink methodology, my irrigation infrastructure would need to include both a storage, may need to include both storage as well as an upgrade in the distribution of irrigation water. Yeah. That it's probably a larger volume than your historical use.
Yeah, and the risk for them is that they're probably going to build a storage that's going to be oversized at the end of the day because if they're putting in a much more efficient system, then they'll end up using less than what the allocation that they've received on paper is.
And all of that can be demonstrated, do you think, mathematically and in writing for the court to see Aqualink historical use? And because these ideas are put out there, but they're not landed on paper. And so,
no, that's true.
It's attractive, but what are the pitfalls?
Again, it's a bit more than anecdotal. I mean, if I can use an example, if you look at Central Plains Water, for example, stage one, they've now got an over-designed system because everything was done, again, and this is not a criticism of the anchoring system, but if you looked at the volumes and the rates and the design, the system designs that were used, they're finding that actually the farmers are getting by on like 4.5 to 4.7 millimetres a day and it was designed for 5.2.
Okay.
Mm. So they're now going, hang on a minute, we're like 20% over designed. Well, we can't increase our command area. We could try, but so while it's not mathematically presented anywhere that the court could grab it and say, well, look, this is what actually happens when you have a efficient use and reasonable and efficient use allocation that's been developed theoretically compared to what is actually physically being used. There's a bit more than anecdotal evidence, but it is sort of really anecdotal.
Okay.
The case studies, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Commissioner, got any questions?
I have just one or two. It won't take very long, hopefully. I just wanted to get a little bit of clarification on the MacArthur Ridge development, if I could.
Yep.
You said originally there were three heads. What can you just clarify what a head is?
A head is 27.67, I think it is, litres a second.
Okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
I mean, it was a crazy number because it was the water that was needed to go through a sluice gun.
Okay.
And if you had one sluice gun, you got a head of water.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, this scheme has a control gate shown on Appendix 3.
Yes.
Where's the water metered? Is it metered? Where is it metered?
No, it's not. So that flows through that control gate, which is periodically, I guess, and I don't know what the frequency is, but the flow through that control gate is gauged. So there's a flow gauging done by the raceman to ensure that the opening on the gate hasn't been changed, I guess, or that the rating still applies. It's actually a very stable structure because there's nowhere else for the water to go. It can only go through that gate. It's fully submerged. So from a hydraulic point of view, it's a precise measure. Without it being a continuous measure, so long as it's always submerged, fully submerged, and the gate opening doesn't... Nobody goes out there and lifts the plate up and down. Then they're going to get their three heads.
And is that a constant supply?
It's a constant supply.
For this development?
Yep. If the pond And you'll have to ask, I don't know how they do this, but you'd have to ask either John Rasmussen, Murray Petrie's not giving evidence, but what I do know is that if their ponds are full and they're not irrigating, they don't take water. So there must be some bypass there that then sends it back into the race.
Okay. You said that the short term, the main, you know, frost fighting water is way, way above irrigation requirement. After they've had a frost and the ponds are emptied, is that the maximum take for this?
Yep.
So the maximum take for this development is not for irrigation but for frost fighting?
No.
Explain, yeah.
No, they just continue to get their three heads.
Okay.
So, you know, if they empty the pond, particularly the bottom pond, which is, so the top pond will still be there. It will be a little bit of water is used for frost fighting up there, but all, most of the frost fighting is done out of the bottom pond. So they could empty the bottom pond in one frost event.
So is there a problem the next day if there's a frost?
Yeah, there could be a problem the next day if there's a frost. Although, you know, they're putting 77-something litres a second into there, so that's a lot of water over 24 hours.
So it should recover.
Yeah, and it, I don't know what they do operationally. I don't know what they do if they get another 6-degree frost tomorrow. They might not have enough water to fright.
Okay. So it's a constant supply, and when
it's a constant
fall,
supply.
They stop.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. That's just clarified for my
understanding. So those are the court's questions. Anything arising?
No.
Right, okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Davron. Should take lunch. Back here at... might as well make it 2:30 because we're going to run out of witnesses shortly. And so we'll take a full lunch.
Mr. Rasmussen is required. If he could be relieved, it would suit him. But
probably only matters of curiosity that are left on my list, which seems an inefficient use of his time.
Yeah. I haven't talked to the commissioners about whether we require him. You got any thoughts? Any questions?
I've got a reasonable understanding for him.
Yeah. Okay. No. And same here. So we don't have any questions. So we could admit the evidence by consent and place whatever weight we see fit to place in it. Happy with that? All right, well, that's what we'll do then. So for the record in relation to the evidence in chief of John Rasmussen, that is admitted by consent. It's admitted by consent. All right, thank you. And so we'll be back here at 2:30.
Please.
Oh, Mr. Moore.
Where to next?
Yeah. I've still got all of those minutes to release. And,
yes. My friend Mr. Van Merlo.
He is here. Yeah.
And I understand he's ready to go.
Okay.
He'd be, but.
That's correct. We can proceed this afternoon if necessary, ma'am.
Yep. No. We're happy to do that. So as to allow me a small chance to catch up on those darned minutes I've been promising, and likely to be releasing minutes on what PC 1 and 8 as well in terms of forward planning there. Can we start at 3 and so I can get some of that paperwork done? And then tomorrow I see that we've got Coase and not sure. Oh, no, we're fine with Coase. I thought there might have been some AVL, but there's not. Okay, all right, so we're adjourned until 3.
Please all stand.